G'day, humans! Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. You may not be aware, but I've been on holidays. We banked a bunch of episodes, and through the miracle of posting things in advance, you've been receiving your constant stream of fabulous, uncomfortable conversations, even while I was lazing around on my big fat derriere in Bali and Singapore. It was delightful. For those of you in the Northern Hemisphere, I sympathize with the Arctic blizzards you've been enduring. I don't mean to rub it in, but I do have a gorgeous tan if you're not watching this, if you're listening to it instead. So I hit the ground running today, and ho Nelly, is there a lot of news? There's a lot going on. It's hard to know exactly where to start with the news out of the United States, with the shootings by ICE officers of protesters in Minneapolis, the Epstein files, or growing authoritarianism in the United States. But I felt that today, when I'm back in the saddle, so to speak, I should focus on something where maybe the rest of the media isn't covering it quite as much or quite as thoughtfully, and it's something in which I have an interest. And if you listen to this show, you too have an interest, which is the freedom of the press and having a media that is courageous enough to have rambunctious and playful and bullshit-free conversations. And so what sort of piqued my interest in recent days out of Minneapolis was specifically the arrest of Don Lemon. Don Lemon worked as a CNN anchor for almost a decade. He was a correspondent for NBC. He was a regular on the Today Show, a regular on NBC Nightly News. He was fired from CNN and went on to independent media, now has a big show on YouTube and you know, does that usual trajectory that we know so well, not naming any names. Not like I'd have any experience of that. And so he was in Minnesota and he was covering the protests and he was arrested, but not at the protests. He wasn't arrested by a cop who was just overly aggressive or pissed off at, you know, how intrusive Don was being. No, he went there, he covered the protests, he'd been covering the protests, and then he flew back to Los Angeles and he was arrested in Los Angeles. We go into the details about why, we go into the charges exactly in this interview, but for me, this is something new and something deeply worrying. I do make a mistake in this conversation. I say that he was arrested while he was on the red carpet at an awards ceremony. He was arrested while he was in Los Angeles to do the red carpet at the Grammys, but he was not there when he got arrested, so apologies in advance for that oversight. I had misread. Nonetheless, I wanted to talk to someone who understands how this fits as a jigsaw piece into the overall strategy of the Trump administration to silence critics, to find pretexts to hound people they don't like, especially people who are doing reporting that they don't like. Before we get to it, in fact, you may have been aware that I was on holiday in Singapore if you are a Substack subscriber, because I did a fabulous and hilarious live stream with the one and only Michael Moynihan from the Fifth Column podcast and from the Free Press while I was in Singapore. And he gave me a lot of shit and I gave him a lot of shit and it was all wonderful. And you would have seen it if you were on Substack. We've got a big week this week coming up in terms of live streams as well. Live stream at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, Eastern US time, which is 9:30 a.m. Wednesday down under, with this show's community manager, Evan Pavanka, who joins us and will increasingly join us to review the highlights and lowlights of recent episodes, with you asking questions and sort of chiming in the chat. That is always fun. So that's at 5:30 Eastern Tuesday. Then a live stream 1 hour later, back to back, ladies and gentlemen. This old chap don't tire. I'll tell you that for nothing. Back to back, right after talking to Evan, we go live with the former Last Week Tonight with John Oliver writer, Jeff Mora, who is going to bring me up to date on everything that's going on in the States and have a conversation about whether or not satire can fix it all. Maybe it can. Sometimes I think that actually throwing your body in the way of an ICE agent and daring them to shoot you or otherwise harm you may not be the most efficacious way to take down a budding authoritarian tyrant. Maybe the way is to laugh at him and to dismiss him while at the same time being generous towards people who have the misfortune of supporting said tyrant. And that's a conversation that I'll have the following day on a Substack Live, the hardest working man in show business, really, let's face it. The following day on Substack Live at the same time, 5:30 p.m. Eastern US time Wednesday. That's 9:30 a.m. Thursday in Sydney and Melbourne. I'll be going back to doing my regular Zeps live streams, where I basically just do an editorial about how I think we could be having better conversations about something that's in the ether at the moment, and what could be in the ether more than Minneapolis and the killing of protesters and the BS that we're hearing, not just from the Trump administration, but also from some leftists who seem to think that the blame is entirely, 100%, 1,000% and totally on the conduct of ICE agents and not at all on the way that the left has framed this particular dispute in the eyes of its more extreme proponents, who would argue that no human is illegal and there should essentially be no immigration enforcement, and any immigration enforcement that makes anybody upset is beyond the pale. There has to be a better way to talk about this, and I will provide my thoughts about how we might do so at 5:30 Eastern Wednesday this week. So if you're not getting those things, if you don't see all of this stuff, then you're probably listening to this as a podcast, or you're getting it through Apple Podcasts or whatever. More and more of the content that we produce is not hitting this podcast feed at all, if you're hearing it on the podcast feed, because I don't want to inundate you with lots of things that you might not be interested in. If you just want to get your episode or two episodes a week of Uncomfortable Conversations, that's totally fine. But I would not want you to be unaware that there is a lot more going on at Substack. And you can watch it all live without paying anything. Just go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com. It's really not hard. It's a one-click process. It'll take you 2 or 3 minutes. And then you can get notified every time we go live. You can watch that without paying. If you want to watch it back after the fact because you miss me, then you will have to pay. The enormous cost of slightly cheaper than one small Starbucks coffee in New York per month. One small Starbucks coffee per month. Not a Frappuccino, not something fancy with vanilla in it and whipped cream on top. A small, normal Starbucks coffee per month to support independent journalism and the kinds of uncomfortable conversations that we try to have here. All right, enough shameless self-promotion. As I said, the question today is whether or not the Trump administration is now basically openly hunting down journalists and finding pretexts to charge them that wouldn't fly in under any other administration, and probably won't end up flying in court, but will threaten a lot of people and will make journalists more wary. Seth Stern is our guest. He is the chief of advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation. As you can probably guess, the job title might give you a little tip off. He's not a big fan of arresting journalists. He's a civil liberties lawyer, and he's a press freedom advocate. And we talked not only about the fascinating details of this particular Don Lemon case, how the government is trying to construct its charges against him and whether or not they would stand, but also the whole history of American attempts to suppress the freedom of the press, to punish whistleblowers. And this is not an entire tirade against Trump. We talk about the Obama administration and Snowden and Assange and Manning and national security secrets and the Biden administration and the prosecution of Donald Trump, in fact, for paying hush money to a porn star during an election campaign. I hope you enjoy as much as I did the one, the only, Seth Stern. The reason I wanted to reach out to you is, of all of the sort of outrages of the Trump administration at the moment and the sense of being on edge that I get from so many of my American friends and colleagues, for some reason, the Don Lemon arrest, it struck me as a kind of a watershed, or like a new low or a new high, however you want to look at it. And maybe it's just because I'm a journalist, but it felt like previously quite a lot of the attacks on free speech or the media had either been bombast or they'd been sufficiently behind the scenes, like Jimmy Kimmel or, you know, Colbert or CBS, or like what exactly is happening, that you can always sort of say, well, it's a bit of a culture war thing. But this isn't a culture war thing. This is an arrest, which of a journalist, which to me was of a high-profile journalist who has been a long critic of Donald Trump's. Maybe just start with what was Don Lemon doing that he was, and what was he charged with?
So Don Lemon was covering a protest at a church in Minneapolis, and the reason that church was targeted for a protest is that the pastor was a higher up in ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, one of the agencies that is arresting non-citizens in Minneapolis and nationwide, oftentimes picking people up off the street who are citizens, causing quite a bit of chaos with their protest backlash. And this was the protest that day. I think Don Lemon had been covering a number of other demonstrations and just the unrest in the city. He followed the protesters into the church, live streamed, attempted to ask the pastor some questions, fairly standard stuff. The charging documents point to the fact that he met with the protesters beforehand in the parking lot, that he followed them, that he said he was not going to, you know, blow their cover. He wasn't going to announce the details of the operation. Journalists see that as source protection. People embed with the military all the time on the condition that they are not going to disclose what the military is doing in advance. That's just sort of understood. It doesn't make you part of the military operation. It doesn't make you responsible for any war crimes the military might commit while you happen to be embedded with them. But in any event, he entered this church along with the protesters, and he was charged, one, on a conspiracy count, which assumes that he conspired to break the law to enter into this church as part of this protest when the thing wasn't his idea. Journalists don't get to choose where the news is going to happen. That's the thing with being a journalist. You follow, if there's a fire, you go to where the fire is. You don't set the fire. If you did that, you would be an arsonist, not a journalist. You follow the news. That's what he did. He didn't conspire to demonstrate at a church. He found out it was happening and he went to document it.
I'm just trying to bend over backwards to give the most generous possible reading to anyone who might sort of lean towards the other side here. In the arson mm-hmm. example, I suppose the claim would be that if you knew that someone was going to go and burn a building down and you knew where they were going to do it and you spoke to them beforehand and then you went along and you documented it, that maybe you're somehow culpable for having been involved in a conspiracy to do the same through the omission of not having reported it in advance. Is that the logic, presumably?
Well, that there is an ethical question, I suppose. If you're aware that a serious, dangerous crime is about to occur, are you under a duty to take off your journalist hat and go tell the authorities? And actually, you know, that's a debate among journalistic ethicists. I don't think the law has any role in it. I've seen that debate play out. Long story, but back when I was practicing law, I was at the law firm that represented the journalist who exposed R. Kelly, the R&B singer, for his sex crimes, of which he was convicted years and years later. And this was a situation where the journalist received in his mailbox from an anonymous source a videotape depicting R. Kelly doing some pretty twisted stuff. And, you know, he decided to hand that tape over to law enforcement because he thought it was more important to get this guy off the streets than, you know, anything else. He was endangering children. And, you know, journalistic ethicists, the armchair, you know, journalism cops, were not happy with him for that. There was a lot of backlash because, you know, journalists shouldn't have anything to do with law enforcement. They're not an arm of the government. You don't assist a law enforcement investigation. That blurs the lines. I get that mentality in some situations. I think when you've got a tape of R. Kelly committing, you know, all sorts of sexual abuses, you make an exception. But that's, again, a conversation for the ethicists among us to have. It is not up to the government to tell journalists how to do their job. Now,
right. And of course, I mean, even on the ethical question, it's obviously different when you're in the middle of an ongoing skirmish between protesters and authorities who a lot of people believe are overreaching their power to document that. And you know, there's not a clear moral imperative necessarily to prevent a disruptive protest from taking place the way there would be to prevent child rape.
Right. Nobody's life is in danger as far as Don Lemon knows. It's a protest. The other aspect of the charges against him, there's a federal law in the United States that was mostly intended to stop anti-abortion protesters from obstructing entrances to abortion clinics, from interfering with people on their way to get, you know, reproductive health services. Probably, I assume, I haven't looked into the legislative history, but I assume as part of the sort of sausage making to create that bill, a deal was made where also churches were included, places of worship were included. And, you know,
yeah, it's a funny law. I read the law, you know, and it's clearly a law which is intended to criminalize obstructive protests outside reproductive health clinics, as the law.
Right.
And then part B of the law says, oh, and also places of worship. And you can just imagine the conservative Republicans whose numbers they needed, or, you know, even the conservative Democrats whose numbers they needed to get the law through, going, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll just make it, you can't be obstructive outside of abortion clinics or churches. They're like, okay, we all agree on that.
Exactly. That's what must have happened. I haven't studied the history, but I bet if we looked into it, we could figure out exactly which names they needed to pick off to get it, you know, over the hump to pass this bill. But in any event, it makes it unlawful to obstruct, interfere with, threaten, injure someone attempting to enter a place of worship and worship. It requires intent, though. So, you know, Don Lemon didn't threaten anybody. He certainly didn't injure anybody. Obstruction is defined to mean physically obstructing someone, not allowing them to come or go. He didn't do that. Interfere is defined to mean physically interfere. He didn't do that. There's intimidate as well. Intimidate is designed to mean place people in a reasonable fear of physical harm. I don't think anybody was afraid that Don Lemon was going to physically harm them. Plus, there's this intent element. His intent wasn't to obstruct a religious service. His intent was to follow the news wherever it led him. If this protest had happened at Starbucks instead of church, he would have been in Starbucks. It wasn't up to him to interfere with anybody's religious service.
Just to reiterate the point that you made earlier, the pastor of the church who was at the church, I assume, was he delivering a sermon at the time, or he was an ICE agent on the side?
He was an ICE deputy. He was one of the top ICE people. I don't remember his exact title, but he was one of the top ICE officials in Minneapolis, where, of course, ICE had, or Border Patrol, but Immigration Enforcement under the same umbrella agency, DHS, had days earlier shot and killed Alex Preddy, and not long before that shot and killed Rene Good, had abducted a 5-year-old. The situation in Minneapolis has been pretty tense for some time because of the action.
But I mean, just to say that the church was not targeted because it's a church. The church was targeted because a person who was participating in the behaviors that the protesters object to was located. And Lemon wasn't charged on the scene. When I heard that he'd been arrested, I instantly sort of fobbed it off. Is that right? And I sort of thought, well, maybe he got involved in a skirmish. And, you know, he was just sort of wrapped up in things, and there was an officer there who decided to charge him. But he went back to Los Angeles. He's on the red carpet of an award ceremony, and cops come up to him and arrest him.
Right. And to your earlier point, the church was targeted entirely because of the ICE agent who was the pastor there. Clergy is very much involved in this protest movement. This isn't some sort of anti-church, anti-Christian protest movement. Plenty of the protesters themselves go to church, even, our clergy.
I mean, that is an interesting theological aside right there, Seth. Like, what is the, what is the, you know, look after the meekest amongst us, and the poor shall inherit the earth, and, you know, give your neighbor the coat off your back, and the kind of charitable essence of Jesus's message. How do you reconcile that with an extremely hardline and aggressive approach towards, I mean, even if you agree with immigration enforcement, the idea that it would be done this way in such a sort of spectacularly, almost proudly authoritarian way, mm-hmm. just optically, is strange. It's not the meek shall inherit the earth all that much. Do you understand the relationship between religious people and this movement?
There are certain in Chicago where I live, the clergy was an essential component of the protest. People were being, and that's powerful. I think just like journalists being arrested, is a powerful scene. Not that anyone's arrest is more important than anyone else's, but it resonates with people when journalists are arrested. That strikes people as abnormal, as opposed to protesters being arrested. You know, that's something people are accustomed to. When clergy is arrested, when a religious leader from the community is arrested, that stands out to people and causes backlash. And in Chicago, there was a lawsuit to restrain the abuses by ICE and Border Patrol, and several religious figures joined that lawsuit as plaintiffs because they had been arrested, assaulted, otherwise had their rights violated by ICE. So no, there are certainly religious figures who are in favor of the Trump administration's policies. But there are also a lot who aren't. No religious community is a monolith. I'm a Jewish atheist, so far be it from me to be talking about, you know, the how to reconcile the contradictions between Jesus's teachings and the Trump administration. I'll leave that to somebody else. But I would say that the religious community has been fighting the good fight. And you know, some not so, but no different than any other community, as far as I can tell.
That's a very generous and fair-minded way of putting it. I just don't quite get how you get from the theology to it. Of course, they're not homogenous. It's just you would expect them, if they claim to believe that the creator of the universe wrote a book, and that the message of that book is that you have to be really kind to people who are down on their luck, that this would not optically be consistent. But anyway, this is not a theological conversation. I mean, I think what's so interesting about your work, Seth, and your long history of commenting on and fighting these kinds of cases is that this is not just a question of whether or not Don Lemon is technically guilty or not guilty of these two crimes. The question is, why are we finding crimes seemingly retroactively to charge enemies of the state with? And you build a clear pattern of case after case after case where, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, what's the case of the home mortgage fraud? The woman, is she a Supreme Court justice or someone who Trump claims lied on her second home mortgage interest deduction form or something?
James, right?
James? Yes, that's right. I only point to that because it's so obvious that they had a person in mind who they wanted to find something wrong with,
right?
And then they go hunting for the crime rather than starting with, here are the crimes that are important to us, and so let's just find whoever it is who is most egregiously flouting them and go after them.
Yeah, it's really the opposite of how it's supposed to work. Prosecutors obviously have discretion to choose which cases to prosecute. You can't prosecute every technical violation of law. You normally choose the cases that you believe to be in the interests of the public to have prosecuted. So when journalists technically trespass or jaywalk in the course of getting the news, you would expect responsible prosecutors to find any reason they could to not prosecute them, to only prosecute them if absolutely necessary, because you don't want to discourage news gathering. You don't want to discourage constitutionally protected journalism that is really core to our system here and in many other places, you know, as well. This is the opposite. This is an administration that is looking for any legal pretext they can find to come after journalists and their sources. They are not looking to avoid chilling news gathering, to avoid interfering with the First Amendment. That is what they want to do. I don't think anybody, well, I'm sure some people doubt this, but I don't think anybody who's watching this from our perspective believes that if Donald Trump was given a magic eraser that could erase the First Amendment, he wouldn't do it in a second. He doesn't like, you know, he doesn't want to safeguard the First Amendment. He's attacking the First Amendment. He's antagonistic to the First Amendment. So he's looking for any reason to prosecute journalists. And as you said, this is unusual. I mean, we do see cases where journalists get arrested at protests. They're arrested by a cop on the street who gets annoyed with them because they're getting in his way to take a picture, or he perceives them as obstructive. And, you know, a vast majority of the time, those cases end up disappearing because some prosecutor takes a look at it and cooler heads prevail. And they say, like, we don't really want to be the prosecutor's office that's going around locking up journalists. So we're going to drop this. But it's the result of a confrontation on the scene. To come after him, not just once. They tried to come after him a week or so ago. They tried to get a judge to authorize his arrest, and two judges actually declined to authorize his arrest. They said, you know, the government is looping the conduct of, I think, eight people together, not distinguishing the journalists from the protesters, and there's no evidence that these journalists committed a crime. So that was already abnormal because, as you said, they're coming in after the fact looking to charge journalists. But then a week later, they went and did it again. They went and got a grand jury to authorize similar charges. So it's really like a relentless pursuit of someone who didn't injure anyone, didn't cause anyone any harm, documented news. And you might have a theory that he technically broke the law. It's a bad theory. He didn't technically break the law, but let's say he had. Is this a good use of our funds as taxpayers? Is this what we want to tell the world about who we are? Is this the direction the country wants to go, where journalists need to just, you know, be on their toes and think, the only way I'm safe is if I don't piss off Donald Trump, because I don't know what the law is. I don't know what the rules are. All I know is that this administration is going to selectively enforce any law it can find to penalize me if they perceive me as an adversary. And it's worth noting.
Please finish.
We've been talking about Don Lemon. There was another journalist also arrested a week later, Georgia Fort, an independent journalist from Minnesota. So while Don Lemon is the high profile name that gets all the headlines, I think the administration is being intentional. They don't want journalists out there, local journalists out there, who have been so key to exposing all of these scandals involving the administration and immigration enforcement in particular. They don't want independent journalists to think, well, we're safe because we're not on their radar. They're only going after the big names. I think Georgia Fort was targeted for a reason, to show no matter how small you are, we'll get you.
And what were Georgia's charges?
Same thing. She also covered the protest at the church.
Right. So conspiring to foment. I mean, it's a funny. I have the law here. I just thought it was. It's a strange. I don't actually understand the first one. The second charge, I do understand, because, you know, it's a law about not obstructing people's access to a place of worship or an abortion clinic. So I suppose you could argue that maybe they obstructed people's access to the church. But the first one, can you explain this to me? It says, if two or more persons conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person in the free exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured to him by the Constitution or laws of the United States. I see. So by impeding a person's participation in their expression of religious faith, because it's at a church,
you are intimidating a person's right to freedom of religion. Okay.
Yeah. Right. It's a conspiracy statute. There needs to be an act in furtherance of the conspiracy.
I see.
Not everyone who was there is a conspirator unless they actually furthered the conspiracy. So if you want to say that the protesters here conspired to deprive the congregants at that church of their religious right to worship, which is flimsy in its own right, because that is not what they conspired to do. They conspired to protest a pastor who was part of the militia that's kidnapping their neighbors.
But I mean, to be fair to the other side, they would say that they knew that in so doing, they would inevitably impede the religious freedoms of the people who are of the congregants.
Yeah. And I suppose a criminal lawyer could talk about the exact intent that is required to be deemed part of a conspiracy. But regardless, that certainly wasn't a conspiracy that Don Lemon or Georgia Fort acted in furtherance of. The conspiracy, the quote unquote conspiracy, was happening with or without them. This was a protest.
Yeah. And I mean, if it were, then anything. I mean, anything that any reporter reports on that's illegal, they're sort of a part of, because they're privy to it in a way that other people aren't, presumably, certainly that other civilians aren't. That's why they're reporting on it, because it wouldn't be a story if everybody already knew about it. So exactly. To some extent, they're conspiring in something secret in the way that they're doing their work. And I mean, when you talk about the impact that you think that Georgia's, not the state, but the person Georgia, sorry, I'm blanking on her last name, the
Georgia
reporter,
Ford, yeah.
Yeah, who was also arrested along with Lemon, the impact that that could have on sort of chilling the enthusiasm of local reporters in Minneapolis and all other jurisdictions where this might take place in reporting fearlessly on the transgressions of the federal government. I mean, one also must just remember that all of us has broken a law. Like, you know, everyone has sped on the highway. Everyone has jaywalked. Everyone has done something that if you found yourself in the crosshairs of, you know, officialdom, could somehow be used to make your life miserable, even if you ended up winning the case, because it would cost you so much and be so stressful. So it's almost beside the point to be arguing over the legitimacy of the charges, in the sense that a journalist was doing his job and then was arrested. And every journalist now knows that there's probably something that they can be arrested for. So they'd better watch their back. I mean, it's fascinating that the federal government went to two judges to try to get them to agree to the charges,
right.
And they were rejected twice. And so then they went, so a grand jury, is a grand jury just a panel of people who?
Essentially, yeah.
It's like a juror pool type thing.
Yeah, except they only hear from the prosecution. And, you know, if you're looking for a grand jury to indict someone, you're going to find it. People to make political points often say, well, this person was indicted from a grand jury of their peers, as if that is, as if that's an indication of guilt, an indication of legitimacy. No, usually if you want to find a grand jury, you're going to find a grand jury. All of these people who Trump has charged, ended up being acquitted in rather humiliating defeats for the administration. You've mentioned some of them. Here in Chicago, there was this guy, Juan Martinez, who had sent some Snapchat messages about Greg Bovino. The administration came up with this narrative that he was...
Sorry, who's Greg Bovino?
Greg Bovino is one of the Border Patrol higher-ups who has been very visible both in Chicago, Minneapolis, Los Angeles as well. He was recently let go for Minneapolis. He was kind of the fall guy, I think, for the Alex Preddy shooting, but chaos seems to follow Greg Bovino. He's someone who's never met a camera he doesn't like, never met a tear gas canister he doesn't like, gives his officers pep talks where he's, you know, whose city is this? Our city. no, it's actually not. You're not from here. He's
even if you were from here, that's not how democracy right. works. It's not your city. Right. It's the people's right. city. Right. We live in America, not.
Yeah. I mean, Greg Bovino is an absolute menace, and I don't in any way want to downplay his, reign of terror. But it is disturbing how everyone's sort of like, oh, well, Greg Bovino's gone from Minneapolis. Tom Homan, another person with an absolutely awful track record, is replacing him, and people are treating it like Tom Homan's, the adult in the room and everything's going to be okay now. It was the instant whitewashing of Tom Homan that you started seeing on television was a bit bothersome. But anyhow.
And wasn't Homan, just as an aside, in Trump's first term, like the bad guy?
He was has been involved with immigration enforcement since the Obama administration, at least. He's sort of a career ICE guy, but now he's unrestrained. Now he's being.
I mean, I may be misremembering, but the point I'm making is that in the first Trump administration, I think Holman was the boogeyman for the left, who was like the worst possible guy because he was presiding over children in cages at the border. Right. And now now we've gone so far, it's gotten so much worse that he's brought in as the nice guy to be the moderate against the excesses of Bovino.
Yeah, I don't know if you even need to go back that far. Until a couple of months ago, no one had heard of Bovino. Homan, along with Kristi Noem, was sort of the face of the operation. Bovino came in. As I said, he's kind of like a flamboyant guy who loves to get in front of the cameras, loves to talk his nonsense. Dresses kind of like a Nazi, probably intentionally, and is he's kind of been hugging the cameras for a while.
This guy who was mocking him on social media, what was that case?
I was just citing that as an example of these defeats that the Trump administration keeps encountering in court. They made up this whole narrative about how this guy was a cartel-tied Latin Kings higher-up who was putting out bounties on the heads of Bovino and other ICE agents. He was a union carpenter who had sent some messages to someone else on Snapchat that it seems like, neighborhood gossip about, 50K for Bovino or something. Nobody who had any power to actually put out a hit on Greg Bovino was acquitted. And my point was only a grand jury indicted him too.
Jury indicted, as the famous saying goes, they'll indict a ham sandwich. Grand jury will indict a ham sandwich.
Get a
prosecutor up in front of them, spinning the right words. The question of targeted prosecutions here and sort of making an example out of people and finding the person who you want to bring down and then finding rationales as to what you can charge them with post hoc. That if I talk to my Trump supporting colleagues who are not fully in the bag, but sort of support him grudgingly, they'll say, yeah, this is bad. This is exactly what the left has brought on itself through its overreach in the past. Does anyone deny that, going after Trump for the hush money that he paid to a porn star was actually a judicious application of the law? When it was obvious that they wanted to get Trump for something and that was the easiest thing to get him for. What do you say to that? Is this a both sides, a pox on both your houses situation, or is this different?
Well, I don't think it is a both sides situation. The Trump administration is particularly egregious in the way it targets its opponents, particularly brazen. That doesn't mean it hasn't been done before. I don't want to go and defend everything that the Biden administration ever did. We were pretty tough on the Biden administration, a Freedom of the Press Foundation as well. In fact, when they attempted to prosecute Project Veritas, which is a right-wing outlet here that is known for doing some pretty unsavory stuff, but when they attempted to prosecute Project Veritas for obtaining a copy of Ashley Biden, the president's daughter's diary, we were pretty upset about that as well. Point being that journalists aren't entitled, as long as they don't break the law, to obtain source material. And the Project Veritas itself was not accused of breaking the law. It was accused of obtaining the diary from someone else who stole it. So, you know, that to us was a very problematic prosecution for press freedom. In the Biden administration, they went after a guy named Tim Burke, who managed to find outtakes of a Tucker Carlson interview with Kanye West, where Kanye West went on what proved to be the first of many anti-Semitic rants. Tucker Carlson cut that out of the interview because at the time they were looking to make Kanye this, you know, reasonable person who was being vilified by the left for supporting Trump, and his ramblings didn't lend themselves to that narrative. So they just cut it. We found that very problematic. You're prosecuting a journalist for finding information online. So, you know, I'm not here to say the Biden administration was perfect or any prior administration was perfect. You know, Obama went after more whistleblowers than anybody in history. There's plenty of blame to go around. But showing up 2 weeks later to arrest a journalist for petty, vindictive charges that are very clearly not in the public interest, that is a line that prior administrations did not cross. Just a couple of weeks ago, raiding a journalist's home, seizing terabytes of data after it had come out that that journalist was talking to a large number of government sources, that's a line past administrations had not crossed. In fact, was against federal law. There was a federal law, the Privacy Protection Act, passed in 1980 in response to a raid of the Stanford Daily newspaper, where I think like three pages were taken from the newspaper, and the cops called in advance to tell them what they wanted. A law was passed in reaction to that because it was considered so offensive to the notion of press freedom. Now we've got hard drives and even smartwatches being seized from journalists. Conditioning access to official spaces, to the president, on language choices, on pledging to not publish unauthorized information, to not essentially do your job. These are lines that nobody in the past has crossed. And of course, the depletion of public records, the decimation of the Freedom of Information Act, the firing of FOIA officers, because, you know, a lot of attention is paid, and rightly so, to the Associated Press being barred from Air Force One for not saying Gulf of America, so on and so forth. You know, that's important, and it's constitutionally significant, and it sets a terrible precedent. But ultimately, the Associated Press reporter will probably get a better story not being on Air Force One. Like, it's kind of good that they get that hour back to not have to listen to a bunch of lies, and they can go do some real journalism. But when they go do that real journalism, if they can't get public records, you know, that's a really big problem. So these are some pretty unprecedented attacks on the press specifically that we're seeing from the Trump administration. The Trump administration didn't they didn't invent politics. They didn't invent political retribution. They didn't invent partisanship, but they are certainly escalating that to the next level when it comes to the press and everything else. And they're dispensing with any pretense otherwise.
Yes. I mean, the dispensing of pretense is an interesting component of it. I mean, the one reason why this feels so new is precisely because of the lack of pretense and the lack of even a nod towards it being virtuous to try to have a sense of comity and respect in a democracy, and a respect for investigative journalism, and a respect for the truth, and a skepticism towards authority. Like, when Obama was, you know, going after whistleblowers, there is no doubt, I don't think, in anyone's mind, even people who hate him, that it was a question that he was taking seriously and that the administration felt that it needed to wrestle with. And they might have come down on the wrong side of that for libertarians, but they probably felt that there was a greater national interest in these facts not being known than in their being known, and that it was worth breaking a few eggs in order to achieve a better outcome for everybody. I think what became hard for a lot of Republicans to swallow was the hush money case on Trump, because it did seem like Trump was guilty of something that, if not criminal, was at least highly immoral and completely contrary to American democratic interests and traditions when he fomented the January 6th riots and didn't tell them to stop and kept on talking about all this evidence that the election was stolen and got on the phone to Raffensperger in Georgia and asked him to find 1,100 votes for him so that he could swing Georgia, and tried to bring fake electors into Congress on January 6th, just hoping that his vice president would allow them to vote in place of the real electors. Like, there was a real conspiracy to prevent the peaceful transfer of power in 2020. And the fact that that didn't become an instant rationale for prosecuting Trump, and the fact that the one that got all the headlines was ultimately the case about did he break election spending rules in some fairly arcane way, because actually the hush money that he paid to a porn star who he had sex with could constitute a donation to his own election campaign because it was, you know, while he was running for president. I mean, that whole thing gave so much, I think, license to conservatives to disingenuously say, look, everybody does targeted prosecutions. The Trump administration is just, as you say, lacking pretense about it. It's almost like the claim that they'll make about Trump's lies, where, you know, do you think that Hillary Clinton wasn't lying all the time? She was, you know, she had her K Street lobbyists and she was cozy with Wall Street, and she'd go off to Davos and then she'd come back and say all the right social justice-y things here in America. And she was just a hypocrite. Trump lies, and he lies to your face, and you know exactly what you're getting, and he throws shit at the wall, and he hunts his opponents, and everybody does it, but at least he's honest about it. And in some respects, I think that's the most corrosive thing, because you're right, this actually is new. Like, with the exception of the hush money case against Trump, none of the cases that I can think of, none of the overreach or the illiberal missteps of the Obama or Biden administrations were motivated by obvious political animus. They weren't going after personal enemies, people who had said mean things about them. They might have been making mistakes about who they thought it was okay, you know, about what the balance should be between freedom and national security. But they weren't just hunting down people they hated because those people said nasty things about them on the air.
Yeah, that's a fair point. In fact, they ran from the perception of doing that. Many people wanted Obama to prosecute W. Bush for any number of things, to come after figures from his predecessor's administration, which he easily could have done considering some of the things that happened in that administration. He chose not to because of the optics of it. He didn't want to set that precedent. I very much, of course, oppose his prosecutions of whistleblowers. I don't know to what extent they were entirely in good faith. I think there is always an element of saving themselves from embarrassment in addition to whatever national security and other interests are at play. But I can imagine Obama and his advisors and his cabinet having a serious conversation about what is for the greater good and debating policy, debating what is in the interests of the American public. I cannot picture Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, and Pam Bondi in a room having a serious policy conversation about what's good for anyone else other than themselves. And, you know, that matters. That matters. Yeah. Even if people do cross the line, even if people do allow the personal and the political to creep into their decision making, knowing that it's wrong, knowing that it can't be the norm, having some pretense, and at least Trump is honest about it, but there is an advantage to having the rule breaker kind of know that there is a rule that they should only break when they believe it absolutely necessary, only break, you know, cautiously. It's like what, you know, yeah, we've got red lights, not because nobody's ever going to run a red light, but because fewer people will run red lights. Fewer people will run intersections and crash their cars if there are red lights than if there aren't. Mm-hmm. If everyone just starts ignoring the red lights altogether, it's a bit of a problem. So,
right. Especially if people start to frame it as a virtue to stand up to those red light ninnies who are trying to take us all over with their stupid red light nonsense, and we're going to just smash the norms because who gives a shit about all of these stupid rules that everyone has put in our way? America first. We're going to run red lights. You know, it's like, let's make America great again, and not have to stop.
And what's the logical outcome of this philosophy of, well, Biden did something similar, so it's okay for Trump to do it. So what, are we just going to get progressively more lawless with each administration because anything the last person did is fair game for the next person? You know, what outcome does that lead to? If you are so offended by something Biden did, then you should be coming after your own guy doubly as hard, saying, hey, we voted for a change. You're acting just like that guy we didn't like. That seems to me to be the reasonable thing to do. If you didn't like Biden and you voted for Trump because you wanted something else, why are you in favor of Trump doing the exact same shit you didn't like when Biden did? And you know, the obvious outcome, okay, a Democrat gets in next and says, well, Trump did this, I'm allowed to do it too. What are you going to say? That's the same thing you did. That's the same excuse you made for Trump. So at some point, it's going to descend into absolute lawlessness if that's the agreement that our politics is formulated on. You know,
Totally. I mean, and it only ratchets one way. You know, it's very, and the further you ratchet down, the harder it is to climb back out of that hole of tit for tat and rebuild a civil society. I mean, just to be maximally generous to Pam Bondi and Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump, the fear would be not that they sit around talking about how to enrich themselves openly, but that they think that the best thing that they can do is to win on behalf of the good people in America. I mean, I suspect that's probably how they frame it for themselves, right? That you don't want to wear cotton gloves when you're going into a fight with people who are trying to destroy the country, and lawless anarchist protesters and sniveling snide journalists who are chirping from the sidelines and always undermining you every time you try to do something great need to get a swift kick in the ass, and that's the way to, you know, make America great again. I mean, I imagine that that's the way that they think about it. And that in some ways is even more dangerous than if it was just raw self-interest, because as you say, there's going to be a Democratic administration someday. And if they come in with an equally divisive and blinkered view of what the good is by defining it only in their version of America, the pure and good version of America that is going to stomp all over the faces of the bad guys, I don't know how you get out of that hole.
Yeah. I don't know. You're being pretty generous there, thinking that they even have some justification in mind. I actually do think they sit in a room and think about how they can profit and grift. That's my perception. I could be wrong.
Maybe they are
true believers. I don't know. Anything's possible, but right. That's, you know, I remember like when I, you know, when you take logic in college, they tell you slippery slopes are a logical fallacy. I don't think that is correct, because we are saying slopes, you know, left and right.
It's something only a logician could say, because it doesn't map onto the world. It is true logically and also completely irrelevant. It's a phenomenon that exists. Can you flesh out for us? Just since you said in passing, Seth, about the whistleblower, Obama's attacks on whistleblowers, that is something that has been memory-holed in my consciousness. Can you tease that out for us? What did he do? Who did he go after? Are there any cases that come to mind?
Well, Snowden's perhaps the most famous one. Chelsea Manning, Drake, there are a number of them. he went after, I think he prosecuted 9 whistleblowers, either 8 or 9, but it was more than every prior president combined. And part of that was because of technologies that hadn't previously existed that both made whistleblowing, leaking documents easier to do and easier to detect. That was certainly part of it. Part of it was also just a deliberate crackdown on his part. We've got a law here in the United States, the Espionage Act, that was passed over 100 years ago and is really poorly written, really vague. But if you take it literally, it makes it a crime to obtain, possess, distribute, publish national defense information. It uses that term, national defense. It doesn't say classified because the classification system didn't even exist yet back then. That is a law that could, at least in theory, based on how it's written, criminalize national security reporting, criminalize what journalists at the New York Times and Washington Post do every day. They obtain national defense information. They report on it. Sometimes nowadays, they even embed the PDF, in a story. Classified or not, doesn't matter under the Espionage Act. Motives don't matter under the Espionage Act. You're treated exactly the same way, whether you're a spy doing the bidding of Russia and China, or whether you're a whistleblower acting out of conscience. So that law is on the books and is rife for abuse. And it is one of those, we've seen so many things with the Trump administration, these sort of honor systems that existed, these norms that existed, and that it was just assumed certain lines would never be crossed. The Espionage Act, Nixon wanted to use it against Daniel Ellsberg for leaking the Pentagon papers. Alberto Gonzalez under the Bush administration threatened to prosecute journalists. A lot of presidents threatened to prosecute journalists under the Espionage Act. No one actually has, because they have realized the extent of the backlash. The closest it has come was Trump in his first term indicting Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher, which the Biden administration then carried out through a plea deal, and press freedom organizations warned of the dangers of that prosecution, because no matter what you think of Julian Assange, what he did, the elements of the crime he was charged with are no different than, as I said, than what the Washington Post and New York Times does every day. And Biden persisted in that prosecution, even when he knew Trump was running for office, even when he knew he was far behind in the polls and Trump was likely to be the next president and was looking for any weapon he could find to wield against journalists. For whatever reason, the Biden administration nonetheless decided to hand Donald Trump that precedent of extracting a plea deal from Julian Assange. So that's the highest danger of the Espionage Act. The way that it had been used before the prospect of going after journalists was on the table was to go after their sources, to go after leakers, whistleblowers. Even that, though, was very rare before the Obama administration, because journalists and sources have a symbiotic relationship. You can't have one without the other. And there was some recognition that, yeah, this law, like you can argue that under the plain language, you can prosecute a leaker, a whistleblower, for going to the press to reveal government misconduct, to reveal corruption, to reveal war crimes even. You can make that case, but should we? Do we want to actually discourage that activity? Shouldn't we stop the war crimes rather than going after the people who expose them? Is that the right look? Is that the message we want to send? Most of the time, no. And Obama changed.
Maybe this is just my political bias because I liked Obama, but my sense was that it really was a new technological moment, and his administration was trying to grapple with something that had never been possible before, which was what my fellow countryman Assange did, which is just dump a tremendous amount of unanalyzed, unredacted material onto
the web, which to me is different from, and just to also, on Biden negotiating a plea deal with Assange, I mean, yes, it's bad because it sets a precedent that they didn't acquit him and stop going after him, but they did free him. I mean, he is back in Australia now, a free man, the Biden administration, right?
Right, right.
So, I mean, but this was also the consequence of a change of government in Australia, where there had been there was a conservative government in power for 11 years who made absolutely no requests to the United States or the UK to sort out the Assange matter because they were right wing and they didn't give a shit. And Australia elected a centre left government, and they started talking aggressively behind the scenes with Washington and saying, "You've got to do something about Assange. He can't just stay in prison forever like this." And
so For Assange personally, yeah, he's free, and obviously being free is a lot better than languishing in prison in poor health. But a plea deal is still a conviction, and it doesn't set a legal precedent the way that an appellate court ruling would. It validates the legal theories under which he was prosecuted. If they had been challenged in court successfully, you couldn't use them again, or at least you would have to think of a different way to take them up. It validates them. It shows that the government successfully extracted a plea deal from a defendant for nothing more than obtaining and publishing national defense information under the Espionage Act. It gives future administrations cover to pursue similar charges. So while there might have been a political compromise,
but I say, but Seth, help me think through the legitimate national security concerns that would be the limiting case for you here, because I felt like the exemplar of who did whistleblowing correctly was Snowden, who took the information. He didn't dump it all on the web. He took it to the most reputable news outlets that he respected the most, and he let them pore over it. And then they took it to the administration and to the government, and they were able to go back and forth about, like, is there anything in here that we're missing that we don't understand is going to cause someone to die or something? And then they published it anyway, whatever was responsible to publish. Like, that was perfect. And the fact that Snowden was punished for that is awful. On the other hand, obtaining nuclear codes and just handing them to North Korea, or just publishing them in a way that, you know, North Korea could find them, or some incredibly deleterious thing to America's national security, or the private addresses of, every American secret agent who's out there, so that the mullahs in Tehran can just execute them all. That presumably deserves to be criminalized, does it not? And to me, Assange did something not dissimilar. I mean, he definitely got people killed. We know he got people killed because there were spies on the subcontinent who were outed in those materials who subsequently disappeared. Where is the line?
Well, I don't know that he got people killed. The judge actually found that he didn't, in authorizing the plea deal, found that there was no showing that he had caused serious harm of the sort that was.
I'd have to go back to those cases, but WikiLeaks was massive. So there was a lot of, huge amount of stuff there. And there was a lot that was, there were certainly people scrambling. Even if you dispute the claims that people got killed, there were people scrambling for their lives to get the hell out of places because all of a sudden they were exposed.
That could be. I would put the onus on the government to protect its information. If you're talking about new technologies, there are new cybersecurity gaps. There are also new fixes available. The government has practically infinite resources to be on the cutting edge and safeguard the information that it absolutely needs to safeguard for the sake of national security. I think its time would be better invested in patching up whatever holes sources exploited than in prosecuting the messenger. That principle is pretty clear in U.S. law outside of the Espionage Act. That is sort of the one statute that makes an exception to that principle, that it is not the job of a journalist to decide or to determine what information the government wants or doesn't want released, what information the government wants them to have.
Be a journalist's job, but isn't it the job of the person who's working for the government who's agreed to keep those secrets? In other words, the whistleblower. Like, I agree that once you're a professional journalist doing journalism, which means talking to, which means, I don't think Assange becomes a journalist just because he dumps a bunch of files on the web. If you're a journalist, you're reading through things, you're poring through things, you're contextualizing things, you're writing about them, you're interviewing people, you're going to the government and asking what their opinion is. You're trying to balance things. You're trying to balance trade-offs, and then you're publishing something. You're not just spewing a fire hose. I don't think that's journalism. But even setting aside the Assange question, if I'm a whistleblower and I've signed on to work in the Pentagon, and I find out that Israel is about to preemptively strike Iran tomorrow, and I just leak it, and then Iran can move its assets or first strike or whatever, and I blow up that plan, should there be no penalty? Is there no legitimate penalty for that?
No, I wouldn't say that there should be no penalty. The problem with the Espionage Act is, as I said, there is no good faith defense. Motive is not a consideration. That person who leaks information about the Israeli strike is going to be treated the same, whether they were acting out of conscience in an attempt to stop a strike that they thought was wrong, as if they are selling that information to the Iranians or to the Russians or whoever it may be. It's called the Espionage Act because it is intended to combat espionage, not whistleblowing. And the penalties under the Espionage Act reflect that intent. So when it is used against somebody who, right or wrong, was acting out of conscience, was not intending to cause the United States harm, was in fact intending to help the United States, perhaps avoid becoming engulfed in a war or committing war crimes, that should be a factor. I mean, even in murder trials, you get to say what your motive was. You get to say this was a crime of passion. You get to say I was acting in self-defense. You don't get that opportunity with the Espionage Act. And when it comes to Assange, you know, there's discussion to be had about whether he released too much, what he should have redacted, how he released the information. Fair academic discussion to have, but under the Espionage Act, it doesn't matter. And that's why it was so problematic for the Biden administration to put that weapon in the hands of Trump. Nothing in the Espionage Act limits prosecution to people who dump documents unredacted onto the web, as opposed to people who publish and contextualize one limited item that they believe to be newsworthy. That you can morally justify, okay, well, here is why prosecutors use their discretion to go after Assange and that they don't use that discretion to go after the New York Times. That is what the Biden administration did. They said, well, we assure you that we would not use this statute to pursue charges against a traditional journalist, but they can only make that promise for themselves. They can't make that promise for Donald Trump.
Right, exactly. Yes. And of course, it just means that journalists are forevermore and whistleblowers sort of serving at the pleasure of the state in a way.
Exactly.
They're just trusting that the state is not going to maliciously misuse a law that it allows the state, that permits the state to do extraordinary things. Let's just wrap with, I just want to go through some of the other things that the Trump administration has been doing that concerns you with regard to press freedom. You write about the North Carolina journalists of The Blade in Asheville who were, just explain what happened there. This was in 2021?
Yeah, and this was local authorities. It wasn't the Trump administration, but the point I was attempting to make there is that the Trump administration is not as creative as people give them credit for. The playbook that they are using now is generally a playbook that we have seen at some point or another at the local level or on the fringes or somewhere that people weren't paying as much attention. So just as Don Lemon, according to the Trump administration, should have dropped his camera and not followed the protesters into the church, even though that is clearly where news was occurring, these two Asheville, North Carolina journalists, Matilda Bliss and Veronica Coit, we're covering a homeless encampment sweep in Asheville when the clock struck 10, and that is when the park curfew was. And according to the Asheville police, even though news was occurring in front of their faces and it is their job to document the news, they should have just turned around and gone home and not covered the news after the clock struck 10 because the public park was closed. And that was
sorry, when you say a homeless encampment sweep, does that mean that authorities were rounding up homeless people?
Yes.
Or what?
Yes, authorities were evicting.
So were the authorities people. Were the authorities trespassing?
I assume I'm not an expert in the Asheville, North Carolina Municipal Code, but I assume the authorities are exempt from the park curfew. But in any event, the notion that a journalist is supposed to have news happening again in front of their faces and not cover it. What if someone got shot at that park? Not that far-fetched, particularly in Minneapolis now. What if an officer at that park took out a gun and shot one of the people they were evicting from that homeless encampment? Were these journalists supposed to just pretend it didn't happen, not look, not go ask questions because they can't step
presumably on this? That is precisely the purpose of the prosecution, isn't it? To make sure that
the
journalists won't be there covering things.
So the point I was making was that we have seen this at the local level. People dismiss it because the Asheville Blade is a fairly radical leftist publication. The founder identifies as an anarchist. Most of the staff are transgender. They have a long history of feuding with the local government. There are so many ways that people can other an outlet like that and say, just like Julian Assange, well, they're different than the real journalists. This will happen to them. It won't happen to, Don Lemon or the Washington Post. Well, then it does. And this conspiracy stuff against Lemon, too. We've seen that in a number of other contexts recently where prosecutors at both the federal and state level have been using RICO laws, racketeering laws, to issue these indictments, these prosecutions for wide-ranging so-called conspiracies where the dots between the people who actually committed crimes and those who are indicted as conspirators really don't connect. A famous one is right. There's in Atlanta, Georgia, there is a police training center called that has become known as Cop City. It's like this sprawling project to basically create a police, funhouse. It's being built. If you've ever been to Atlanta, Atlanta's kind of a city in a forest. I used to live there. It's unique in that sense. And it's being built on forest, land that environmentalists would like to see preserved. So there's been a pretty active protest against Cop City. In the course of those protests, a couple of people have attacked officers, damaged police vehicles, so on and so forth. The indictment connects those folks with people who merely distributed literature, spoke to the media at press conferences, held certain ideologies, anarchists essentially, with very little actual connection, evidence of their involvement in any crime. It's essentially they were like-minded people who traveled in the same circles, and therefore they're all conspirators. That's also happened in cases at the federal level. One guy was indicted solely for possessing and transporting literature, anti-establishment sort of pamphlets and zines. With absolutely
is this
no
connection. The Daniel Sanchez case?
The Daniel Sanchez case. His wife, he wasn't even there. His wife was at a protest where allegedly an officer was shot. There's no allegation that his wife was the shooter. That's not even under, that's not even in the atmosphere. But Daniel Sanchez was arrested for the sole reason that he moved some anarchist literature from their home to somewhere else. They're calling that concealment of evidence. Evidence of what? Of reading anarchist zines. I don't know. My point is that these tactics start on the fringes, and before you know it, end up with Don Lemon's doorstep. Mm. You know, this idea that by being around certain people, by even potentially being sympathetic to them, because, you know, journalistic objectivity, people forget, is an industry norm. It's not a matter of law. If Don Lemon was sympathetic to those protesters, that's his business. That has no bearing on his constitutional rights. But these loose-knit conspiracies that tie First Amendment protected free speech, constitutionally protected activity, to alleged crimes through this reach to connect those dots, that's something we've been seeing for a while, but it's been relegated to, again, the fringes.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned RICO laws, Seth, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that these laws were created to target the mob because the mob was so good, and all organized crime is so good at keeping everything at arm's length, that you can never get the people who you really want to get because they can always keep themselves a slight distance away from any proof of their connection to it. So these laws allowed prosecutors to say, you don't have to prove that the person was actually involved. If you can prove that they're part of a general collective who were responsible for doing these things, then the individual can be, you know, found guilty and incarcerated, even if there's no proof that they actually did it, because we all know the way the mob works. But the idea of transposing that onto something like some Texas activist who happens to have anarchist literature, whose wife was at a rally where someone was shot, you know, that means that he is culpable for the shooting. A, it's completely authoritarian. And B, how can the right wing not see that this could be flipped in the next Democratic administration? And Tucker Carlson and Megyn Kelly and Ben Shapiro and Stephen Miller could all be linked to some crazy person who does something that they would not approve of. Or, you know, an anti-abortion activist could be held liable for someone who assassinates an abortion doctor. I mean, there is, how tenuous does the connection have to be in order to constitute a Do you want to just, how would you fix this? Like, what do you get rid of the Espionage Act and get rid of RICO laws? Do you add extra laws on top to clarify their use? Like, what is the, do you rely on the courts to interpret them better? Assuming that we can't rely on politicians and presidents to fix the problem, certainly not this administration, if any, how would you how would you shore up press freedom in America?
Well, there, in terms of the Espionage Act, there have been legislative proposals to fix it that we very much support. One of them is soon going to be reintroduced by Representative Tlaib, who obviously is not going to have many friends on the right. So I'm under no illusion that it is going to pass this time around. But yeah, I would hope that as the right does sort of grapple with the idea that the shoe is one day going to be on the other foot. You know, I think when Trump first got into office, people were kind of thinking the party was going to go on forever. The prospect of the cards being reversed was the furthest thing from the minds of some on the right. That might change soon. And maybe then there can be more support for closing some of these loopholes by reforming the Espionage Act. RICO, I think the guy who wrote RICO has essentially apologized for creating this mess. So it's not exactly a radical idea that we should get rid of RICO. Like you said, it was intended for mob prosecutions and has morphed into something totally different. And although what RICO changed was you didn't need to independently have committed a criminal act to be considered part of a criminal enterprise. You needed to commit an action in furtherance of the criminal conspiracy. Still, that in furtherance element has almost been read out of it. Transporting the anarchist zine or giving press conferences about Stop Cop City is in no way in furtherance of some other protester throwing a rock at a police car. So Rico has just been expanded into a total mess, and it's not really a press freedom issue as much as a free speech in general issue. But more broadly, I don't know that it's a problem we can legislate our way out of. The judiciary plays a key role. The judiciary has upheld the First Amendment to an extent, with some exceptions. But even that, as Trump knows better than anybody, isn't an effective solution, because legal services in the United States are prohibitively expensive, and we've got a media that is in dire financial straits. Defending a lawsuit, let alone going on offense to get an injunction to stop the administration's practices, is a drain on time, a drain on resources, a drain on money. Even if you ultimately win, nobody wants to be fighting those battles. So when it comes down to it, I think the backlash needs to come from the public, and from the press itself. You know, never go to war with the guy who owns the printing press is the old adage, but too often the press doesn't want to insert itself into these battles. They feel like it's navel gazing. They feel like they're making themselves the story that makes them uncomfortable. I think that needs to change. The press needs to stand up for itself. The press needs to fight these battles. And covering the story is not navel gazing. It is crucial news. It's our democracy kind of depends on these freedoms persevering. So if you don't cover that story because it feels a little bit awkward to you, you're doing your readers a disservice. You know, get over it and cover the news. And if you're the news, so be it. That wasn't your decision. That was the administration's decision. And I do think the American public cares about this stuff. No disrespect to people like Don Lemon and Jimmy Kimmel, but I don't think that the backlash we see in those cases is because these people taken to the streets are Don Lemon and Jimmy Kimmel superfans. Both of their shows are, I've seen both of their shows. They're fine. They're not best journalism or the best late night television on the planet. I don't recall the public being overly upset when Don Lemon was taken off of CNN. I'm sure he had people who were into his show who were slightly bummed, but it's not as though these are like these iconic cultural figures. But their names people know, and people, that's what it takes to get people involved, maybe a name they know. But these are the people who are upset about this. I don't think it's like a personal Don Lemon thing. I think they're upset about the principle. The American public still cares about these principles, despite the efforts of the administration and many before them to demonize the media. Whatever people think of reporters, they do appreciate press freedom, despite the loud contingent on the right that might celebrate this kind of stuff. There is a public backlash. And it's unfortunate that it requires, you know, celebrities like Kimmel and Lemon to get involved before people really speak up. But, you know, I get it. It's more relatable. It's a name they know. But when it's put in people's faces like that, they care. And you know, politicians should pay a political cost. And I think until Trump, I doubt that. I'm pretty certain that prior presidents would have loved to arrest journalists who criticized them. I don't think Trump's the first one who had that impulse. I think in the past, they figured there would be political consequences to doing that. Trump made a bet that there wouldn't be, and he needs to lose that bet. So, because you know, the law we're seeing right now, the law is only worth so much. The court system, even when it works in the long run, it's almost an afterthought. The intimidation comes from the charges or the lawsuit, not from the eventual outcome. The only thing can save us is the public.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's hope the Democratic Party gets its shit together and things go their way in November. Seth, fabulous to talk to you. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, and we'll keep an eye on the Democrats too if they do.
Exactly. See you.